the ruby in the center of its hilt, the stone smoldering in the firelight. Aelin had felt the arrow he'd received during the fight with Manon at Temis's temple, or enough of a jolt that she'd known in that moment that they were mates. Yet he hadn't felt anything at all that day on the beach. He had a feeling he knew the answer, knew that Maeve was likely the cause of it, the damper on what was between them. She'd gone into his head to trick him into thinking Lyria was his mate, had fooled the very instincts that made him a fey male. It wouldn't be beyond her powers to find a way to stifle what was between him and Aelin, to keep him from knowing that she'd been in such danger, and now to keep him from finding her. But he should have known about Aelin. Shouldn't have waited to get the wyverns and the others. Should have flown right to the beach and not wasted those precious minutes. Mate. His mate. He should have known about that too. Even if rage and grief had turned him into a miserable bastard, he should have known who she was, what she was, from the moment he'd bitten her at Mistward, unable to stop the urge to claim her. The moment her blood had landed on his tongue and it had sung to him, and then refused to leave him alone, its taste lingering for months. Instead, they'd brawled. He'd let them brawl, so lost in his anger and ice. She'd been just as raging as he, and had spat such a hateful, unspeakable thing that he'd treated her like any of the males and females who had been under his command and mouthed off. But those early days still haunted him. Though Rowan knew that if he ever mentioned the brawling they'd done with a lick of shame, Aelin would curse him for a fool. He didn't know what to do about the tattoo down his face, his neck and arm. The lie it told of his loss, and the truth it revealed of his blindness. He'd come to love Lyria. That had been true. And the guilt of it ate him alive whenever he thought of it. But he could understand now. Why Lyria had been so frightened of him for those initial months. Why it had been so damn hard to court her, even with that mating bond. Its truth unknown to Lyria as well. She had been gentle and quiet and kind. A different sort of strength, yes, but not what he might have chosen for himself. He hated himself for thinking it. Even as the rage consumed him at the thought, at what had been stolen from him, from Lyria too. Aelin had been his and he had been hers from the start, longer than that. And Maeve had thought to break them, break her to get what she wanted. He wouldn't let that go unpunished. Just as he could not forget that Lyria, regardless of what truly existed between them, had been carrying their child when Maeve had sent those enemy forces to his mountain home. He would never forgive that. "I will kill you," Aelin had said when she'd heard what Maeve had done. How badly Maeve had manipulated him, shattered him, and destroyed Lyria. Elide had told him every word of the encounter over and over. "I will kill you." Rowan stared into the burning heart of Goldrin's ruby. He prayed that fire, that rage had not broken. He knew how many days it had been, knew who Maeve had promised would oversee the torture, knew the odds were stacked against her. He'd spent 2 weeks strapped on an enemy's table, still bore the scar on his arm from one of their more creative devices. Hurry. They had to hurry. Rowan leaned forward, resting his brow against Goldrin's hilt. The metal was warm, as if it still held a whisper of its bearer's flame. He had not set foot in Acadia since that last horrible war. Though he'd led fey and mortal soldiers alike to victory, he'd never had any desire to see it again. But to Acadia they would go. And if he found her? If he freed her? Rowan did not let himself think beyond that. To the other truth they would face, the other burden. "Tell Rowan that I'm sorry I lied. But tell him it was all borrowed time anyway. Even before today, I knew it was all just borrowed time. But I still wish we'd had more of it." He refused to accept that. Would never accept that she would be the ultimate cost to end this, to save their world. Rowan scanned the blanket of stars overhead. While all other constellations had wheeled past, the Lord of the North remained. the immortal star between his antlers pointing the way home. To Terrasen. Tell him he has to fight. He must save Terrasen. And remember the vows he made to me. Time was not on their side. Not with Maeve, not with the war unleashing itself back on their own continent. But he had no intention of returning without her, parting request or no, regardless of the oaths he'd sworn upon marrying her to guard and rule Terrasen. And tell him thank you for walking that dark path with me back to the light. It had been his honor. From the very beginning, it had been his honor. The greatest of his immortal life. An immortal life they would share together, somehow. He'd allow no other alternative. Rowan silently swore it to the stars. He could have sworn the Lord of the North flickered in response. Chapter 6. The winter winds off the rough waves had chilled Kaol Westfall from the moment he'd emerged from his quarters below decks. Even with his thick blue cloak, the damp cold seeped into his bones. And now, as he scanned the water, it seemed the heavy cloud cover wasn't likely to break anytime soon. Winter was creeping over the continent, as surely as Morath's legions. The brisk dawn had revealed nothing, only the roiling seas and the stoic sailors and soldiers who had kept this ship traveling swiftly northward. Behind them, flanking them, half of the Coggan's fleet followed. The other half still lingered in the southern continent as the rest of the mighty empire's armada rallied. They'd only be a few weeks behind, if the weather held. Kaol sent a prayer on the briny, icy wind that it would. For despite the size of the fleet gathered behind him, and despite the 1,000 Rook riders who were just now taking to the skies from their roosts on the ships for morning hunts over the waves, it might still not be enough against Morath. And they might not arrive fast enough for that army to make a difference anyway. 3 weeks of sailing had brought them little news of the host his friends had assembled and supposedly brought to Terrasen. And they'd kept far enough from the coast to avoid any enemy ships, or wyverns. But that would change today. A delicate warm arm looped through his, and a head of brown gold hair leaned against his shoulder. "It's freezing out here," Irene murmured, scowling at the wind-whipped waves. Kaol pressed a kiss to the top of her head.
"The cold builds character."
She huffed a laugh, the steam of her breath torn away by the wind. "Spoken like a man from the north." Kaol slid his arm around her shoulders, tucking her into his side.
"Am I not keeping you warm enough these days, wife?"
Irene blushed and elbowed him in the ribs.
"Cad."
Over a month later, he was still marveling at the word, wife. At the woman by his side, who had healed his fractured and weary soul. His spine was secondary to that. He'd spent these long days on the ship practicing how he might fight, whether by horseback or with a cane or from his wheeled chair. During the times when Irene's power became drained enough that the life bond between them stretched thin, and the injury took over once more. His spine hadn't healed, not truly. It never would. It had been the cost of saving his life after a Volg princess had taken him to death's threshold. But even now, yet it did not feel like a cost too steeply paid. It had never been a burden. The chair, the injury, it would not be now. But the other part of that bargain with the goddess who had guided Irene her entire life, who had brought her to Antica's shores and now back to their own continent, that part scared the hell out of him. If he died, Irene went as well. To funnel her healing power into him so he might walk when her magic was not too drained, their very lives had been entwined. So if he fell in battle against Morath's legions, it would not be just his own life lost.
"You're thinking too hard."
Irene frowned up at him. "What is it?" Kaol jerked his chin toward the ship sailing nearest their own. On its stern, Two rooks, one golden and one reddish-brown, stood at attention. Both were already saddled, though there was no sign of Kadara's or Salki's riders. I can't tell if you're motioning to the rooks, or the fact that Nezrin and Sartak are smart enough to remain in bed on a morning like this. As we should be, her golden brown eyes added tartly. It was Kaol's turn to nudge her with an elbow.
You're the one who woke me up this morning, you know.
He brushed a kiss to the column of her neck, a precise reminder of how exactly Irene had awoken him, and what they'd spent a good hour around dawn doing. Just the warmed silk of her skin against his lips was enough to heat his chilled bones.
We can go back to bed, if you want,
he murmured. Irene let out a soft, breathless sound that had his hands aching to roam along her bundled-up body. Even with time pressing upon them, hurrying them northward, he'd loved learning all her sounds, loved coaxing them from her. But Kaol drew his head away from the crook of her neck to gesture again to the rooks.
They're heading on a scouting mission soon.
He'd bet that Nezrin and the Coggins' newly crowned heir were currently buckling on weapons and layers.
We've sailed far enough north that we need information on where to moor.
So they could decide where exactly to dock the armada and march inland as quickly as possible. If Rifthold was still held by Erewhon and the Iron Teeth Legions, then sailing the armada up the Avery and marching northward into Terrasen would be unwise. But the Vol King might very well have forces lying in wait at any point ahead. Not to mention Queen Maeve's fleet, which had vanished after her battle with Aelin, and mercifully remained unaccounted for. By their captain's calculations, they were just nearing the border Fenharrow shared with Otterlin. So they needed to decide where exactly they were sailing to, as swiftly as possible. They'd already lost precious time skirting the Dead Islands, despite the news that they once more belonged to Captain Rolf. Word had likely already reached Morath about their journey, but there was no need to proclaim their exact location. But their secrecy had cost them. He'd had no news on Dorian's location, not a whisper as to whether he had gone north with Aelin and the fleet she'd gathered from several kingdoms. Kaol could only pray that Dorian had, and that his king remained safe. Irene studied the two rooks on the nearby ship. How many scouts are going?
Just them.
Irene's eyes flared with warning.
Easier for smaller numbers to stay hidden.
Kaol pointed to the sky.
The cloud cover today makes it ideal for scouting, too.
When the worry in her face didn't abate, he added,
We will have to fight in this war at some point, Irene.
How many lives did Erewhon claim for every day that they delayed?
I know.
She clasped the silver locket at her neck. He'd given it to her. Had a master engraver carve the mountains and seas onto the surface. Inside, it still bore the note Aelin Galathinius had left her years ago, when his wife worked as a barmaid in a backwater port, and the queen lived as an assassin under another name.
I know it's foolish, but I somehow didn't think it would come upon us this quickly.
He'd hardly call these weeks at sea quick, but he understood what she meant.
These last days will be the longest yet.
Irene nestled into his side, her arm going around his waist.
I need to check on the supplies. I'll get Borte to fly me over to Hassar's ship.
Arcus, the fierce Rook rider's mount, was still dozing where he slept on the stern.
You might have to wait a while for that.
Indeed, they both learned these weeks not to disturb either Rook or Ryder while they were sleeping. Gods help them if Borte and Aelin ever met. Irene smiled and lifted her hands to cup his face. Her clear eyes scanned his.
I love you,
she said softly. Kaol lowered his brow until it rested against hers.
Tell me that when we're knee-deep in freezing mud, will you?
She snorted, but made no move to pull away. Neither did he. So brow to brow and soul to soul, they stood there amid the bitter wind and lashing waves, and waited to see what the rooks might discover.
She'd forgotten how damn cold it was in the north. Even while living amongst the Rook Riders in the Tavern Mountains, Nezrin Falik had never been this frozen through. And winter had not fully descended. Yet Salki showed no hint that the cold affected him as they rushed over cloud and sea. But that might also be because Kadara flew beside him, the golden Rook unfaltering in the bitter wind. A soft spot. Her Rook had developed a soft spot and an undimming admiration for Sartak's mount. Though Nezrin supposed the same could be said about her and the Rook's rider. Nezrin tore her eyes from the swirling gray clouds and glanced to the rider at her left. His shorn hair had grown out, barely, just enough to be braided back against the wind. Sensing her attention, the heir to the Khaganate signaled, "All is well." Nezrin blushed despite the cold, but signaled back, her numbed fingers clumsy over the symbols. "All clear." A blushing schoolgirl. That's what she became around the prince, no matter the fact that they'd been sharing a bed these weeks, or what he'd promised for their future. To rule beside him, as the future empress of the Khaganate. It was absurd, of course. The idea of her dressed like his mother, in those sweeping beautiful robes and grand headdresses. No, she was better suited to the Rook in leathers, to the weight of steel, not jewels. She'd said as much to Sartak, many times. He'd laughed her off. Had said she might walk around the palace naked if she wished. What she wore or didn't wear wouldn't bother him in the least. But it was still a ridiculous notion. One the prince seemed to think was the only course for their future. He'd staked his crown on it. Had told his father that if being prince meant not being with her, then he'd walk away from the throne. The Khagan had offered him the title of heir instead. Before they'd left, his siblings had not seemed angered by it, though they'd spent their entire lives vying to be crowned their father's heir. Even Hasar, who sailed with them, had refrained from her usual sharp-tongued comments. Whether Kaushin, Argan, or Duva, all still in Antica, with Kaushin promised to sail with the rest of his father's forces, had changed their minds about Sartak's appointment, Nezrin didn't know. A flutter of activity to her right had her steering sulky after it. Falcon Enar, shapeshifter and merchant-turned-Rukin spy, had taken a falcon's form this morning and wielded the creature's remarkable speed to fly ahead. He must have seen something, for he now banked and swept past them, then soared inland again. "Follow," he seemed to say. Sailing to Terrasen was still an option, depending on what they found today along the coast. Whether Lysandra might be there, if she might still be alive, was another matter entirely. Falcon had sworn that his fortune, his properties, would be her inheritance well before he knew that she'd survived childhood or received his family's gifts. A strange family from the wastes, who'd spread across the continent, his brother ending up in Otterlin long enough to sire Lysandra and abandon her mother. But Falcon had not spoken of those desires since they'd left the Tavern Mountains, and had instead dedicated himself to helping in whatever manner he could. Scouting, mostly. But a time would soon come when they'd need his further assistance, as they had against the Karen Kui in the Dagul Fells. Perhaps as vital as the army they'd brought with them was the information they'd gleaned there. That Maeve was not a Fey Queen at all, but a Volg imposter. An ancient Volg queen, who had infiltrated Dorinel at the dawn of time, ripping into the two sister queens' minds and convincing them that they had an elder sister. Perhaps the knowledge would bring about nothing in this war, but it might shift it in some way. To know that another enemy lurked at their backs, and that Maeve had fled to Aurelia to escape the Volg king she'd wed, brother to two others, who in turn had sundered the word keys from the gate and ripped through worlds to find her. That the three Volg kings had broken into this world only to be halted here, unaware that their prey now lurked on a throne in Dorinel, had been a strange twist of fate. Only Erewhon remained here of those three kings, brother to Orcus, Maeve's husband. What would he pay to know who she truly was? It was a question perhaps for others to ponder,
to consider how to wield. Falcon dropped into a swooping dive through the cloud cover, and Nezrin followed. Cold, misty air ripped at her, but Nezrin leaned into the descent, Salky trailing Falcon without command. For a minute, only clouds flowed past, and then white cliffs rose from the gray waves, and beyond them dried grasses spread in the last of Fenharrow's northernmost plains. Falcon soared toward the shore, checking his speed so he didn't lose them. Kadara kept pace with them easily, and they flew in silence as the coast grew clearer. The grasses on the plains weren't winter dried. They'd been burned. And the trees, barren of leaves, were little more than husks. On the horizon, plumes of smoke stained the winter sky. Too many and too great to be farmers scorching the last of the crops to fertilize the soil. Nezrin signaled to Sartak, "I'm taking a closer look." The prince signaled back, "Skim the clouds, but don't get below them." Nezrin nodded, and she and Haruk disappeared into the thin bottom layer of the clouds. Through occasional gaps, glimpses of the charred land flashed below. Villages and farmsteads, gone, as if a force had swept in from the sea and razed everything in its path. But there had been no armada camped by the shore. No, this army had been on foot. Keeping just within the veil of clouds, Nezrin and Sartak crossed the land. Her heart pounded, faster and faster with every league of seared, barren landscape they covered. No signs of an opposing army or ongoing battles. They'd burned it for their own sick enjoyment. Nezrin marked the land, the features she could make out. They'd indeed barely crossed over Fenharrow's borders, Otterlin a sprawl to the north. But inland, growing closer with each league, an army marched. It stretched for miles and miles, black and writhing. The might of Morath, or some terrible fraction of it, sent to instill terror and destruction before the final wave. Sartak signaled, "A band of soldiers below." Nezrin peered over Salky's wing, the drop merciless, and beheld a small group of soldiers in dark armor wending through the trees, an offshoot of the teeming mass far ahead. As if they had been sent to hunt down any survivors. Nezrin's jaw clenched, and she signaled back to the prince, "Let's go." Not back to the ships, but to the six soldiers, beginning the long return trek to their host. Nezrin and Salky plummeted through the sky, Sartak a blur on her left. The band of soldiers didn't have the chance to shout before Nezrin and Sartak were upon them. Lady Irene Westfall, formerly Irene Towers, had counted the supplies about six times now. Every boat was full of them, yet Princess Hasar's ship, the personal escort to the healer on high, held the most vital mix of tonics and salves. Many had been crafted prior to sailing from Antica. But Irene and the other healers who had accompanied the army had spent long hours concocting them as best they could on board. In the dim hold, Irene steadied her feet against the rocking of the waves and closed the lid on the crate of salve tins, jotting down the number on the piece of paper she'd brought with her.
"The same number as 2 days ago,"
an old voice clucked from the stairs. Hafiza, the healer on high, sat on the wooden steps, hands resting atop the heavy wool skirt covering her skinny knees.
"What do you worry will happen to them, Irene?"
Irene flicked her braid over a shoulder.
"I wanted to make sure I'd counted right."
"Again?"
Irene pocketed the piece of parchment and swept up her fur-lined cloak from where she'd tossed it over a crate.
"When we're on the battlefields, keeping stock of our supplies
will be vital, yes, but also impossible. When we're on the battlefields, girl, you'll be lucky if you can even find one of these tins amid the chaos."
"That's what I'm trying to avoid."
The healer on high offered her a sympathetic sigh.
"People will die, Irene. In horrible, painful ways, they will die. And even you and I will not be able to save them.
Irene swallowed. I know that. If they did not hurry, did not make landfall soon and discover where the Khagan's army would march, how many more would perish? The ancient woman's knowing look didn't fade. Always, from the first moment Irene had laid eyes on Hafiza, she had emanated this calm, this reassurance. The thought of the healer on high on those bloody battlefields made Irene's stomach churn. Even if this sort of thing was precisely why they had come, why they trained in the first place. But that was without the matter of the Volg, squatting in human hosts like parasites. Volg who would kill them immediately if they knew what the healers planned to do. What Irene planned to do to any Volg who crossed her path.
The salves are made, Irene,
Hafiza groaned, as she rose from her perch on the steps and adjusted the lapels of her thick woolen jacket, cut and embroidered in the style of the Dargon riders. A gift from the last visit the healer on high had made to the steps, when she'd taken Irene along with her.
They are counted. There are no more supplies with which to make them. Not until we reach land and can see what might be used there.
Irene clutched her cloak to her chest.
I need to be doing something.
The healer on high patted the railing.
You will, Irene. Soon enough, you will.
Hafiza ascended the stairs with that, leaving Irene in the hold amid the stacks of crates. She didn't tell the healer on high that she wasn't entirely sure how much longer she'd be a help. Not yet. Hadn't whispered a word of that doubt to anyone. Even Kaol. Irene's hand drifted across her abdomen and lingered. Chapter 7 Morath. The final key was at Morath. The knowledge hung over Dorian through the night, keeping him from sleep. When he did doze, he awoke with a hand at his neck, grasping for a collar that was not there. He had to find some way to go, some way to reach it. Since Manon would undoubtedly be unwilling to take him, even if she'd been the one who'd suggested he might be able to take Aelin's place to forge the lock. The 13 had barely escaped Morath. They were in no hurry to return. Not when their task in finding the Krokins had become so vital. Not when Erewhon might very well sense their arrival before they neared the keep. Gavin had claimed the path would find him here, in this camp. But finding a way to convince the 13 to remain, when instinct and urgency compelled them to move on, that might prove as impossible a task as attaining the third word key. Their camp stirred in the gray light of dawn, and Dorian gave up on sleep. Rising, he found Manon's bedroll packed, and the witch herself standing with Astarin and Sorrel by their mounts. It was that trio he'd have to convince to remain. Somehow. Already waiting near the mouth of the pass, the other wyverns shifted as they readied for the unbearably cold flight. Another day, another hunt for a clan of witches who had no desire to be found, and would likely have little desire to join this war.
We move out in 5 minutes.
Sorrel's rocky voice carried across the camp. Convincing would have to wait then. Delaying it was. Within 3 minutes, the fire was out and weapons were donned, bedrolls bound to saddles and needs seen to before the long day of flying. Buckling on Damaris, Dorian aimed for Manon, the witch standing with that preternatural stillness. Beautiful. Even here in the blasted snow, a shaggy goat pelt slung over her shoulders. As he neared, her eyes met his in a flash of burnt gold. Astarin gave him a wicked grin.
Morning, Your Majesty.
Dorian inclined his head.
Where are we wandering today?
He knew the casual words didn't quite meet his eyes.
We were just debating it,
Sorrel answered. The third's face stony but open. Behind them, Vesta swore as the buckle on her saddle came undone. Dorian didn't dare to look, to confirm that the invisible hands of his magic had worked.
We already searched north of here,
Asterin said. Let's keep heading south. Make it to the end of the Fangs before we backtrack.
They might not even be in the mountains, Sorrel countered. We've hunted them in the lowlands in decades past.
Manon listened with a cool, unruffled expression, as she did every morning, weighing their words, listening to the wind that sang to her.
Imogen's saddlebag snapped free of its tether. The witch hissed as she dismounted to retie it. How long these little delays could keep them here, he didn't know. Not indefinitely.
If we abandon these mountains, Asterin argued, then we'll be far more trackable in the open lands. Both our enemies and the Krakens will spot us before we ever find them.
It'd be warmer, Sorrel grumbled. Eelway would be a hell of a lot warmer. Apparently, even immortal witches with steel in their veins could grow tired of the leeching cold. But to go so far south into Eelway, when they were still near enough to Morath? Manon seemed to consider that, too. Her eyes dipped to his jacket, to the keys within, as if she could sense their pulsing whisper, their slide against his power. All that lay between Erewhon and his dominion over Aurelia. To bring them within 100 miles of Morath? No, she'd never allow it. Dorian kept his face blandly pleasant, a hand resting on the eye-shaped pommel of Damaris. This camp has no clues about where they went? He knew they hadn't the faintest notion. Knew it, but waited for their answer anyway, trying not to grip Damaris's pommel too hard. No, Manon said with a hint of a growl. Yet Damaris gave no answer beyond a faint warmth in the metal. He didn't know what he'd expected. Some verifying hum of power, a confirming voice in his mind. Certainly not the unimpressive whisper of heat. Heat for truth, likely cold for lies. But at least Gavin had spoken true about the blade. He shouldn't have doubted it, considering the god Gavin still honored. Holding his stare with that relentless, predatory focus, Manon gave the order to move out. Northward. Away from Morath. Dorian opened his mouth, casting for anything to say, do to delay this departure. Short of snapping a wyvern's wing, there was nothing. The witches turned toward the wyverns, where Dorian would ride with one of the sentinels for the next leg of this endless hunt. But Abraxos roared, lunging for Manon with a snap of teeth. As Manon whirled, Dorian's magic surged, already lashing at the unseen foe. A mighty white bear had risen from the snow behind her. Teeth flashing, it brought down its massive paw. Manon ducked, rolling to the side, and Dorian hurled out a wall of his magic, wind and ice. The bear was blasted back, hitting the snow with an icy thump. It was instantly up again, racing for Manon. Only Manon. Half a thought had Dorian flinging invisible hands to halt the beast. Just as it collided with his magic, snow spraying, light flashed. He knew that light. A shifter. But it was not Lysandra who emerged from the bear's perfectly camouflaged hide. No. The thing that came out of the bear was made of nightmares. A spider. A great Stygian spider. Big as a horse and black as night. Its many eyes narrowed on Manon, pincers clicking as it hissed.
Blackbeak.
The Stygian spider had found her. Somehow. After all these months, after the thousands of leagues Manon had traveled over sky and earth and sea. The spider from whom she'd stolen the silk to reinforce Abraxos's wings had found her. But the spider had not anticipated the 13, or the power of the King of Otterlin. Manon drew Windcleaver as Dorian held the spider in place with his magic, the king showing little signs of strain. Powerful. He grew more powerful each day. The 13 closed ranks, weapons gleaming in the blinding sun and snow, the wyverns forming a wall of leathery hides and claws behind them. Manon stalked a few steps closer to those twitching pincers. You're a long way from the runes, sister. the spider hissed.
You are not so very hard to find, despite it. You know this beast?
Asterin asked, prowling to Manon's side. Manon's mouth curled in a cruel smile. She donated the spider silk for Abraxos's wings. The spider snarled.
You stole my silk and shoved me and my weavers off a cliff.
How is it that you can shapeshift? Dorian asked, still pinning the spider in place, as he approached Manon's other side, one hand gripping the hilt of his ancient sword. The legends make no mention of that. Curiosity indeed brightened on his face. She supposed the white line through his golden skin on his throat was proof that he'd dealt with far worse, and supposed that whatever bond lay between them was also proof he had little fear of pain or death. A good trait for a witch, yes, but in a mortal, it would likely wind up getting him killed. Perhaps it was not a lack of fear, but rather a lack of whatever mortals deemed vital to their souls, ripped from him by his father and that Vogue demon. The spider seethed.
I took 2 decades from a young merchant's life in exchange for my silk. The gift of his shifting flowed through his life force. Some of it, at least.
All those eyes narrowed on Manon.
He willingly paid the price. Kill her and be done with it,
Asterin murmured. The spider recoiled as much as the king's invisible leash would allow.
I had no idea our sisters had become so cowardly. If they now require magic to skewer us like pigs.
Manon lifted Windcleaver, contemplating where between the spider's many eyes to plunge the blade.
Shall we see if you squeal like one when I do?
Coward, the spider spat. Release me. And we'll end this the old way.
Manon debated it, then shrugged.
I shall keep this painless. Consider that my debt owed to you.
Sucking in a breath, Manon readied for the blow.
Wait!
The spider breathed the word.
Wait.
From insults to pleading, Asterin murmured.
Who is spineless now?
The spider ignored the second. Her depthless eyes devouring Manon, then Dorian.
Do you know what moves in the south? What horrors gather?
Old news, Vesta said, snorting.
How do you think I found you?
The spider asked. Manon stilled.
So many possessions left at Morath. Your scents all over them.
If the spider had found them here that easily, they had to move out. Now. The spider hissed.
Shall I tell you what I spied a mere 50 miles south of here? Who I saw? Blackbeak?
Manon stiffened.
Crokins,
the spider said, then sighed deeply, hungrily. Manon blinked. Just once. The 13 had gone equally still. Asterin asked,
You've seen the Crokins?
The spider's massive head bobbed in a nod before she sighed again.
The Crokins always tasted of what I imagine summer wine to be like. What chocolate, as you call it, would taste like.
Where?
Manon demanded. The spider named the location, vague and unfamiliar.
I will show you where.
She said,
I will guide you.
It could be a trap, Sorrel said.
It's not, Dorian said, his hand still on the hilt of his sword. Manon studied the clarity of his eyes, the squared shoulders, the pitiless face, yet inquisitive angle to his head.
Let's see if her information holds true, and decide her fate afterward.
Manon blurted, What? The 13 shifted at the denied kill. Dorian jerked his chin to the shuddering spider.
Don't kill her.
Not yet.
There's more she might know beyond the Crokin's whereabouts.
The spider hissed.
I do not need a boy's mercy.
It is a king's mercy you receive, Dorian said coldly. And I'd suggest being quiet long enough to receive it.
Rarely. So rarely did Manon hear that voice from him. The tone that sent a thrill through her blood and bones. A king's voice. But he was not her king. He was not the coven leader of the 13.
We let her live and she'll sell us to the highest bidder. Dorian's sapphire eyes churned. The hand on his sword tightening. Manon tensed at that contemplative cold stare. The hint of the calculating predator beneath the king's handsome face.
He only said to the spider,
You mastered shape-shifting in a matter of months, it seems.
A path would find him here, Gavin had said. A path into Morath. Not a physical road, not a course of travel, but this. The unholy terror remained quiet for a beat before she said,
Our gifts are strange and hungry things. We feed not just on your life, but your powers too, if you possess them. Once magic was freed, I learned to wield the abilities the shapeshifter had transferred to me.
Damaris warmed in his hand. Truth. Every word the spider had spoken had been truth. And this? A way into Morath? As something else entirely. In another's skin. Perhaps a human slave like Elide Locken. Someone whose presence would go unmarked. His raw power had lent itself to every other form of magic, able to move between flame and ice and healing. To shapeshift. Might he learn it too? Dorian only asked the spider, Do you have a name?
A king without his crown asks for a lowly spider's name,
she murmured, her depthless eyes setting on him.
You cannot pronounce it in your tongue, but you may call me Cyrene.
Manon ground her teeth. It doesn't matter what we call you, as you'll be dead soon. But Dorian cut her a sidelong glance. The runes are part of my kingdom. As such, Cyrene is one of my subjects. I think that gives me the right to decide whether she lives or dies.
You are both at the mercy of my coven, Manon snarled. Step aside.
Dorian gave her a slight smile.
Am I?
A wind colder than the mountain air filled the pass. He could kill them all. Whether by choking the air from them or snapping their necks. He could kill them all, and the wyverns included. The knowledge carved out another hollow within him, another empty spot. Had it ever troubled his father, or Aelin, to bear such power? Bring her with us. Question her more thoroughly at the next camp. Manon snapped, You plan to bring that with us? In answer, the spider shifted, donning the form of a pale-skinned, dark-haired woman. Small and unremarkable, save for those unnerving black eyes. Not pretty, but with a deadly, ancient sort of allure that even a new hide couldn't conceal. And utterly naked. She shivered, rubbing her hands down her thin arms.
Shall this form suffice to travel lightly?
Manon ignored the spider.
And when she shifts in the night to rip us apart?
Dorian only inclined his head, ice dancing at his fingertips.
She won't.
Cyrene sucked in a breath.
A rare gift of magic.
Her stare turned ravenous as she took in Dorian.
For a rare king.
Dorian only frowned with distaste. Manon glanced to Asterin. Her second's eyes were wary. Her mouth a tight line.
Sorrel, a few feet behind, glowered at the spider, but her hand had dropped from her sword.
The 13, on some unspoken signal, peeled away to their wyverns. Only Cyrene watched them, those horrible, soulless eyes blinking every now and then as her teeth began to clack. Manon angled her head at him.
You're
different today. He shrugged. If you want someone to warm your bed who cowers at your every word and obeys every command, look elsewhere.
Her stare drifted to the pale band around his throat.
I'm still not convinced, princeling, she hissed, that I shouldn't just kill her.
And what would it take, witchling, to convince you?
He didn't bother to hide the sensual promise in his words, nor their edge.
A muscle flickered in Manon's jaw.
Things from legends. That's who surrounded him.
The witches, the spider.
He might as well have been a character in one of the books he'd lent Aelin last fall.
Though none of them had ever endured such a yawning pit inside them. Scowling at her bare feet in the snow, Cyrene's hands twitched at her sides, an echo of the pincers she'd borne moments before.
Dorian tried not to shudder. Suicide to sneak into Morath, once he learned what he needed from this thing.
The weight of Manon's gaze fell upon him again, and Dorian didn't balk from it.
Didn't balk from Manon's words as she said, If you find so little value in your existence that it compels you to trust this thing, then by all means, bring her along.
A challenge, to look not toward Morath or the spider, but inward.
She saw exactly what gnawed on his empty chest, if only because a similar beast gnawed on her own.
We'll find out soon enough whether she spoke true about the Krokins.
The spider had. Damaris had warmed in his hand when Cyrene had spoken. And when they found the Krokins, when the 13 were distracted, he'd learned what he needed from the spider, too.
Manon turned to the 13, the witches thrumming with impatience.
We fly now. We can reach the Krokins by nightfall.
And what then?
Asterin asked, the only one of them who had permission to do so.
Manon stalked for Abraxos, and Dorian followed, tossing Cyrene a spare cloak as his magic tugged her with him.
And then we make our move.
Manon hedged. And for once, she did not meet anyone's stare. Didn't do anything but gaze southward.
The witch was keeping secrets too. But were hers as dire as his?
Chapter 8. Blackness greeted Aelin as she rose to consciousness. Tight, contained blackness. A shift of her elbows had them digging into the sides of the box, chains reverberating through the small space. Her bare feet could graze the end if she wriggled slightly. She lifted her bound hands to the solid wall of iron mere inches above her face, traced the whorls and suns embossed onto its surface. Even on the inside, Maeve had ordered them etched, so Aelin might never forget that this box had been made for her, long before she'd been born. But those were her own bare fingertips brushing over the cool, rough metal. He'd taken off the iron gauntlets, or had forgotten to put them back on after what he'd done. The way he'd held them over the open brazier, until the metal was red hot around her hands and she was screaming, screaming. Aelin pressed her palms flat against the metal lid and pushed. The shattered arm, the splinters of bone jutting from her skin, gone. Or had never been. But it had felt real. More so than the other memories that pressed in, demanding she acknowledge them, accept them. Aelin shoved her palms against the iron, muscles straining. It didn't so much as shift. She tried again. That she had the strength to do so was thanks to the other services Maeve's healers provided, keeping her muscles from atrophying while she lay here. A soft whine echoed into the box. A warning. Aelin lowered her hands just as the lock grated and the door groaned open. Cairn's footsteps were faster this time. Urgent.
Relieve yourself in the hall and wait by this door,
he snapped at Fenris. Aelin braced herself as those steps halted. A grunt and hiss of metal and firelight poured in.
She blinked against it, but kept still. They'd anchored her irons into the box itself. She'd learned that the hard way. Cairn didn't say anything as he unfastened the chains from their anchor. The most dangerous time for him, right before he moved her to the anchors on the altar. Even with her feet and hands bound, he took no chances. He didn't today, either, despite not bothering with the gauntlets. Perhaps they'd melted away over that brazier, along with her skin. Cairn yanked her upright as half a dozen guards silently appeared in the doorway. Their faces held no horror at what had been done to her. She'd seen these males before, on a bloodied bit of beach.
Varric,
Cairn said, and one of the guards stepped forward, Fenris now at his side by the door, the wolf as tall as a pony. Varric's sword rested against Fenris's throat. Cairn gripped her chains, tugging her against his chest as they walked toward the guards, the wolf.
You make a move, and he dies.
Aelin didn't tell him she wasn't entirely sure she had the strength to try anything, let alone run. Heaviness settled into her. She didn't fight the black sack shoved over her head as they passed through the arched doorway. Didn't fight as they walked down that hall, though she counted the steps and turns. She didn't care if Cairn was smart enough to add in a few extras to disorient her. She counted them anyway. Listened to the rush of the river, growing louder with each turn, the rising mist that chilled her exposed skin, slicking the stones beneath her feet. Then open air. She couldn't see it, but it grazed damp fingers over her skin, whispering of the gaping openness of the world. Run. Now. The words were a distant murmur. She had no doubt the guard's blade remained at Fenris's throat, that it would spill blood. Maeve's order of restraint bound Fenris too, well, along with that strange gift of his to leap between short distances, as if he were moving from one room to another. She'd long since lost hope he'd find some way to use it, to bear them away from here. She doubted he'd miraculously reclaim the ability should the guard's sword strike. Yet if she heeded that voice, if she ran, was the cost of his life worth her own?
You're debating it, aren't you?
Cairn hissed in her ear. She could feel his smile even through the sack blinding her.
If the wolf's life is a fair cost to get away.
A lover's laugh.
Try it. See how far you get. We've a few minutes of walking left.
She ignored him, ignored that voice whispering to run, run, run. Step after step, they walked. Her legs shook with the effort. It told her enough about how long she had been here, how long she had not been able to properly move, even with the healer's ministrations to keep her muscles from wasting away. Cairn led her up a winding staircase that had her rasping for breath, the mist fading away to cool night air. Sweet smells. Flowers. Flowers still existed. In this world, this hell, flowers bloomed somewhere. The water's bellow faded behind them to a blessedly dull rushing, soon replaced by merry trickling ahead. Fountains. Cold, smooth tiles bit into her feet, and through the hood flickering fire cast golden ripples. Lanterns. The air tightened, grew still. A courtyard, perhaps. Lightning pulsed down her thighs, her calves, warning her to slow, to rest. Then open air yawned again wide around her, the water once more roaring. Cairn halted, yanking her against his towering body, his various weapons digging into her chains, her skin. The other guards' clothes rustled as they stopped, too. Fenris's claws clicked on stone, the sound no doubt meant to signal her that he remained nearby. She realized why he'd feel the need to do so, as a female voice that was both young and old, amused and soulless, purred.
Remove the hood, Cairn.
It vanished, and Aelin needed only a few blinks to take everything in. She had been here before, had been on this broad veranda overlooking a mighty river and waterfalls, had walked through the ancient stone city she knew loomed at her back, had stood in this very spot, facing the dark-haired queen lounging on a stone throne atop the dais, mist wreathing the air around her, a white owl perched on the back of her seat. Only one wolf lay sprawled at her feet this time, black as night, black as the queen's eyes, which settled on Aelin, narrowing with pleasure. Maeve seemed content to let Aelin look. Let her take it in. Maeve's deep purple gown glistened like the mists behind her, its long train draped over the few steps of the dais, pooling toward. Aelin beheld what glittered at the base of those steps and went still. Maeve's red lips curved into a smile as she waved an ivory hand.
If you will, Cairn.
The male didn't hesitate as he hauled Aelin toward what lay on the ground. Shattered glass, piled and arranged in a neat circle. He halted just outside, the first of the thick shards an inch from Aelin's bare toes. Maeve motioned to the black wolf at her feet, and he rose, plucking up something from the throne's broad arm before trotting to Cairn.
I thought your rank should at least be acknowledged, Maeve said,
that spider's smile never faltering, as Aelin beheld what the wolf offered to the guard beside Cairn.
Put it on her,
the queen ordered. A crown, ancient and glimmering, shone in the guard's hands, crafted of silver and pearl, fashioned into upswept wings that met in its peaked center, encircled with spikes of pure diamond. It shimmered like the moon's rays had been captured within, as the guard set it upon Aelin's head. A terrible, surprising weight, the cool metal digging into her scalp. Far heavier than it looked, as if it had a core of solid iron. A different sort of shackle. It always had been. Aelin reined in the urge to recoil, to shake the thing from her head.
Mab's crown, Maeve said. Your crown, by blood and birthright. Her true heir.
Aelin ignored the words, stared toward the circle of glass shards.
Oh, that,
Maeve said, noting her attention.
I think you know how this shall go, Aelin of the Wildfire.
Aelin said nothing. Maeve gave a nod. Cairn shoved her forward right into the glass. Her bare feet sliced open, new skin shrieking as it ripped. She inhaled sharply through her teeth, swallowing her cry just as Cairn pushed her onto her knees. The breath slammed from her at the impact, at each shard that sliced and dug in deep.
Breathe.
Breathing was key, was vital. She pulled her mind out, away, inhaling and exhaling, a wave sweeping back from the shore, then returning. Warmth pooled beneath her knees, her calves and ankles, the coppery scent of her blood rising to blend into the mists. Her breath turned jagged as she began shaking, as a scream surged within her. She bit her lip, canines piercing flesh. She would not scream. Not yet. Breathe. Breathe. The tang of her blood coated her mouth as she bit down harder.
A pity that there's no audience to witness this, said Maeve,
her voice far away and yet too near.
Aelin Firebringer, wearing her proper Faerie Queen's crown at last, kneeling at my feet.
A tremor shuddered through Aelin, rocking her body enough that the glass found new angles, new entries. She drifted further back, away. Each breath tugged her out to sea, to a place where words and feelings and pain became a distant shore. Maeve snapped her fingers.
Fenris.
The wolf padded past and sat himself beside her throne, but not before he glanced at the black wolf. Just a turn of the head. The black wolf returned the look, bland and cold. And that was enough for Maeve to say,
Connell, you may finally tell your twin what you wish to say.
A flash of light. Aelin inhaled through her nose, exhaled through her mouth, over and over. barely registered the beautiful dark-haired male who now stood in place of the wolf. Bronze-skinned like his twin, but without the wildness, without the mischief shining from his face. He wore a warrior's layered clothes, black to Fenris's usual gray, twin knives hanging at his sides. The white wolf stared up at his twin, rooted to the spot by that invisible bond.
"Speak freely, Connell," Maeve said, her faint smile remaining.
The barn owl perched on the back of her throne watched with solemn, unblinking eyes.
"Let your brother know these words are your own, and not of my command."
A booted foot nudged Aelin's spine, a subtle jab forward, harder into the glass. No amount of breathing could draw her far enough away to rein in the muffled whimper. She hated it, hated that sound, as much as she hated the queen before her and the sadist at her back. But it still made its way out, barely audible over the thundering falls. Fenris's dark eyes shot toward her. He blinked 4 times. She could not bring herself to blink back, her fingers curled and uncurled in her lap.
"You brought this upon yourself," Connell said to Fenris, drawing his brother's attention once more.
His voice was as icy as Maeve's.
"Your arrogance, your unchecked recklessness, was this what you wanted?"
Fenris didn't answer.
"You couldn't let me have this, have any part of this for myself. You took the blood oath not to serve our queen, but so you couldn't be bested by me for once in your life."
Fenris bared his teeth. Even a something like grief dimmed his stare. Another burning wave washed through her knees, across her thighs. Aelin closed her eyes against it. She would endure this, would bear down on this. Her people had suffered for 10 years, were likely suffering now. For their sake, she would do this, embrace it, outlast it. Connell's rumbling voice rippled.